The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia. My name is Andy Cahan, Director of Author Events, and I am pleased to welcome our guest this evening. Michael Smirkanish is the host of a daily radio program heard nationwide on Sirius XM's POTUS channel. He is also the host of CNN's Smirkanish, which airs Saturdays at 9 a.m. and 6 p.m. He is a newspaper columnist for the Sunday Philadelphia Inquirer, and his columns are routinely printed in newspapers across the country. He is the author of 7 books. His last book, the novel Talk, was optioned by Warner Brothers for a television series. His 7th and most recent book is titled Clowns to the Left of Me, Jokers to the Right, American Life in Columns. Smirkanish is a Phi Beta Kappa graduate of Lehigh University and the University of Pennsylvania Law School, and he resides in the Philadelphia suburbs where he and his wife have raised 4 children. Please join me in welcoming Michael Smirkanish.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, I was for the Iraq invasion, but I'm against the Cuban embargo. I've supported capital punishment, but I think there's too much fighting in hockey. I was for profiling at airports post-September 11. I was also supportive of the idea of using harsh interrogation methods for presumed terrorists at Guantanamo Bay, pretty conservative stuff. But I think that both pot and prostitution should be legalized. Oh, really? Okay. Now I know what I'm dealing with tonight. I want to end the Scholastic Aptitude Test, the SAT. But I wish for us to continue to teach our kids how to write in cursive. I am for breaking up Pennsylvania's stranglehold on the sale of alcohol, and I'd like to see the U.S. Treasury discontinue manufacture of the copper penny. Those are all my opinions, or at least they were at one time, as expressed in columns. I feel like at this point I should be saying, I'm Michael Smirkanish, and I approve this message. But they're hard to classify, don't you think? Which explains the title of my brand new book, Clowns to the Left of Me, Jokers to the Right, American Life in Columns. I borrowed the title from that 1972 Steelers Wheel hit, and it is the theme song of my daily radio program on Sirius XM. The book is a collection of 100 of what I consider to be my more memorable columns from the 1,047, by my count, that I published in the Philadelphia Daily News and or Inquirer between 2001 and 2016. By the way, I'm not making a penny, copper or otherwise, on this project. All author proceeds benefit the Children's Crisis Treatment Center, CCTC, which is Philadelphia-based and provides, thank you, social services to kids in our area who are the victim of trauma. So if you read a situation in the Inquirer or watch it in the local news and it involves catastrophic consequences for kids and you wonder, my gosh, who's caring for them now? Chances are that it's CCTC. These are some CCTC kids, by the way. My wife, Lavinia, full disclosure, is on the board of CCTC. I also want to thank at the outset the Philadelphia Inquirer and Daily News. They did a wonderful job in supporting me in this project in terms of the copyrights, and I'm most proud of being able to say that Temple University Press, I do hope that you'll purchase the book. but I want everybody to know that Temple University Press did a spectacular job on the production values of it, and I feel so good about that because it's such a local and home team enterprise. So thank you, Temple. I was honored in 2001 when Zach Stallberg, who was then the editor of the Philadelphia Daily News, invited me to be a columnist for the Daily News. It was then Brian Tierney, during his tenure as owner of the Philadelphia Inquirer, who brought me aboard at the Inquirer. For a time period, I was the only person. Today, you'll see bylines of individuals in both the Daily News and Inquirer, but I was the first and only person for quite some time to be writing for both, the Daily News on Tuesday and then the Inquirer on Sundays. It was a natural for me. I had majored in both government and journalism at Lehigh University. I enjoyed it when I came aboard at the Daily News and they had some fun at the expense of my last name, which I'm used to. I think it was actually a play on McDonald's supersized campaign at that moment. But I learned something in compiling the book, and that is that when I was given a column in 2001, it was not the first time that I had appeared in print in the Philadelphia Daily News. I had long forgotten that in 1985, at the end of my first year in law school at Penn, I had published an essay in the Daily News under the headline, "America Offers Opportunity to Those Who Work." That's me with hair. In the book, I revisit those columns that I've published, and this is the very first one that I revisit. I still think that America is a land of opportunity, but I have a more nuanced perspective now on that issue, and frankly, most everything else that I've ever written about. I had a tendency to see things in rather stark black and white terms in that part of my life, and a large part of the fun for me was re-exploring opinions that I had offered. I joined the Daily News after the events of September 11, and over the next 15 years, I wrote on that subject more than any other during the course of my columns and column writing. My very first column, as a matter of fact, dealt with that subject matter. I argued that Rudy Giuliani should be the Secretary of Homeland Security. Now, I thought and still believe that Rudy had exhibited good leadership qualities in the aftermath of September 11. But as I say in the book, I was wrong in writing that. But not for the reasons you're snickering. It had nothing to do with his representation of the president. It's just that I think that Tom Ridge, our former governor, was a hell of a Secretary of Homeland Security, and I don't know why I didn't think of Tom to begin with. Writing a column, I came to learn, is more difficult a proposition that you might think in the 3 to 4 minutes that it takes you to read them. My work on radio and television is often stream of conscious, but writing a column forces me to be more deliberative, or at least it should. And rereading my columns, rereading all 1,047 of them, here's what I've come to realize and appreciate. I have been right, I have been wrong, and mostly I've been fortunate. There are some things that I nailed in print. I wanted us to disregard Pakistan's sovereignty long before we knew that bin Laden was hiding at Abbottabad. I called BS on the Duke lacrosse case from the get-go. And in 2012, I argued that Chris Christie needed to hurry and run for president or surely he would burn out, and that was before Bridgegate. But like I said, there's plenty that I've gotten wrong. I once entertained a conspiracy theory regarding the bombing of the Murrah building in Oklahoma City. I was convinced for a while that there had been Iraqi involvement with McVeigh and Nichols. My first reaction to the Citizens United case was positive. Yikes. And ladies and gentlemen, I said many times in print and on radio, and on television, he will never run, much less be elected president of the United States. I'll tell you something else about writing a column. You have to weigh in on everything. Women with tattoos, what to build at Ground Zero, kids and their trophies, scandal in the church, scandal at Penn State, even the zoo balloon. I'm against it. Gaper delay, that's all it does. The Boy Scouts, Terry Schiavo's end of life, summer jobs, whether to permit the Barnes Foundation to move into Philadelphia. I love the Barnes. I still disagree with that decision. And where to locate the Rizzo statue. Looking back, there are some things I'm reading that I have no idea what I was thinking at the time. What does that even mean? Like I said, I have weighed in on everything. 16 years ago, I took umbrage with a move to change the Miss America pageant and make it more about scholarship than beauty. This was 16 years ago, not the recent getting rid of the bikinis. Long before the era of hashtag Me Too, I may or may not have written these words. Quote, if the pageant wants to become a televised Mensa meeting, that's their choice. But I have a hunch America wouldn't mind a little more of an old-fashioned beauty pageant. Bring back the busty baton twirler. Until then, Burt Parks will continue to roll over in his grave. Sometimes I've been able to break news with my writing. I was honored when the father of a fallen Marine asked me to tell his true family story. I want to show you Lance Corporal Matthew Snyder. He died on March 3rd, 2006 in Operation Iraqi Freedom. And after he died, you'll remember this part of the story, his father not only had to deal with the pain of burying his only son, but also to endure the taunts of the so-called Westboro Baptist Church showing up with despicable signs. You remember what they put on those signs. Well, Al Snyder, the father, to his credit, fought Westboro Baptist all the way to the Supreme Court of the United States with an invasion of privacy claim. Unfortunately, he was unsuccessful. What the public never knew and what he entrusted me to reveal is that all the while fighting for the memory of his son, he kept secret the fact that he is gay. Something unknown to Westboro, but known to his son. And Al let me tell that story. This is Al with his then partner, Walt. The two sat together, holding hands, as that case was argued in the Supreme Court of the United States. Like I said, right, wrong, and fortunate. Right place, right time. I have felt over the years privileged to be a little Forrest Gumpish in a Philadelphia sense. And oftentimes there were backstories that never made the column itself. I've written about how in 1980, as a newly minted 18-year-old Republican from Doylestown, I skipped high school with a buddy to meet Ronald Reagan in the Italian market during a campaign visit. We took the Reading train from Doylestown to the old terminal, came in the shed. I had taken my pocket Instamatic camera with us, but I didn't want to carry the flash. You see the word sausage over Ronald Reagan's head? That's Esposito's Meat Market at 9th and Christian. When the picture came back from Photomat, anybody remember Photomat? We've all got pictures like that. I should say that luckily I had another chance at a fundraiser for Arlen Specter in 1980 to meet the Gipper before I went off to college in the Rose Garden at the Bellevue Stratford, and this time I brought the flash. That was August of 80. I now went to Bethlehem to begin studying at Lehigh, mistakenly thinking that other students shared my passion for politics and my interest in Republican politics in particular, and neither was true. I formed a club that I called Lehigh University Youth for Reagan Bush. It was very difficult to attract members. I had a brainchild, and the brainchild was that I would throw a keg party and bring the multitude of Reagan Bush supporters out of their dorm rooms. I happened to select a night that the Phillies were playing the Kansas City Royals and Steve Carlton was pitching and nobody came to the kegger. Which is why when the telephone rang in my dormitory, I lived in Taylor House, 150 guys, pre-internet, no cell phones, and it would take an act of divine intervention for you to get a competent phone message. And one day I picked up the phone and the message was to tell me that my club was needed to supply motorcade drivers for a visit that Ambassador George Bush, that's what Papa Bush's title was at the time, he was making an 11th hour visit to the Bethlehem Steel Plant during a shift change. So I hung up the phone and I recruited liberal, communist, independent, conservative, who wants to work for George Bush for a few days? And then after the visit ended, we dutifully lined up and met him. That experience was the beginning of my relationship with Papa Bush. At age 20, I became an advance man for him and was able to travel across the country and twice around the world planning the logistics of his personal appearances, which also set the stage when I was 29 to be appointed to a sub-cabinet level position in the Department of Housing and Urban Development, where I was responsible for public housing in five states and Washington, D.C., and Jack Kemp was my boss. The appointment came with the support of my friend, Pennsylvania's longest-serving United States Senator Arlen Specter. You will remember that as a young lawyer working for the Warren Commission, it was now, I would say, Senator Specter, it was then Arlen Specter who came up with the single bullet theory. Or as he would school me later in life, he would say, Michael, it's the single bullet conclusion, because he believed that he had proven it during the course of his life. Specter wrote about his Warren Commission work for his memoir, which was called Passion for Truth. And I remember interviewing him on radio in Philadelphia about the book, and in a gratuitous way telling him, visiting Cuba is, for me, a bucket list item. He had just traveled to Cuba and interviewed Fidel Castro so that he could have the Cuban perspective on the issue of the Kennedy assassination. And I said to Senator Specter one day on City Line Avenue, if you ever go back, I'll sit in the luggage. I'd really like to go. Lo and behold, he called me during the holidays. This would have been 2001 into 2002, inviting me, so long as I could be credentialed from the Daily News, to accompany him to Havana, which I did, and that's how I got to spend 7 hours in the company of Fidel Castro at his home in a very intimate setting. I have to tell, this is a Philly audience, I have to tell you a story that you'll appreciate that I wouldn't share around the country. But what do you ask Fidel Castro, right? You're a journalist, you have this unique once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. What do you ask Castro? I'll tell you what I asked him, among other things. I said to him, Mr. President, and by the way, Cuban Americans are still livid with me for referring to him as Mr. President, but what else am I going to say? I'm in his house. I said, Mr. President, I come from Philadelphia, and we had a very colorful mayor in our town. Anybody know where this is going yet? Who once said that his police department could invade your island and win. Do you remember that Rizzo line? I said, I'm curious, have you ever heard of that statement being made? And there was an interpreter, although I don't think that he needed her. I think he used her as a crutch to get his head together. And Castro nevertheless gathered his thoughts and looked at me and said, I've never heard of such a statement being made, but I can assure you it's false. Which I then wrote about in the Daily News. We argued about world events. In questioning him, I was able to get him 3 months after September 11 to condemn Islamic terror. It was a subject about which he had some interesting insights. But what I most remember about the night and what didn't make it into the Daily News is this. At the end of the evening, I'm a cigar smoker, something I'd revealed to him early on. He handed to me a box of what was then a new Cuban brand called Trinidad's. And I had him sign the top of the box across the label. I came home and I showed it to my wife. My wife was ecstatic. I didn't understand why. And then she said to me, well, the kids' school auction is in a week. this is going to go for a huge number. And I had to explain to her, it's the most valuable item in my estate. It probably still is. It's going nowhere. I conducted President Obama's first live radio interview from the White House. And that, too, was great column fodder. But there's more to the story. I had been promised 30 minutes one-on-one with President Obama and told that the interview would be carried live on CNN, MSNBC, and Fox, that there were no questions that were off limits, and that I could include my radio callers so that they could ask what they wanted to ask. I thought that I had planned for every eventuality, but there was something I hadn't considered, and that was that he would arrive early, which he did. Now, you need to understand this. Thousands of people suggested questions to me of what I needed to ask him live on radio and television. You must ask this. You must ask this. And that extended to my dinner table the night before I went to 30th Street, got on the train, and went down to the White House. Our sons were then, I think, 10, 12, and 14. And one of them said, "Dad, make sure you ask the president about the Book of Secrets." I said, "Okay, remind me." I said, "Well, Dad, we just saw Nicolas Cage in National Treasure 2. Don't you remember the president, when he gets elected, gets the Resolute Desk and the Book of Secrets? And the Book of Secrets explains who killed Kennedy, what's in Area 51, and did we really land on the moon?" I said, "Okay, but I don't think I'm going to have the chance." So president extends a hand. I extend a hand. There's an expression in my business. You don't want to leave it in the locker room. Even presidents forget, you know, things that they said during a commercial break versus when they're on air. So I can't get into substance. So what did I say? I said, "Mr. President, nice to be in the White House. What's in the Book of Secrets?" To which he replied without batting an eyelash, "I would tell you, but I'd have to kill you." Now, the interview proceeded, and I achieved my objective. I didn't embarrass myself. There are no YouTube moments as a result of one-on-one with Barack Obama, the first of, by the way, seven interviews that I did with him. We talked about the hunt for bin Laden, because bin Laden had not yet been captured, killed, anything. We talked about the Affordable Care Act, because it had not yet been passed. And we talked about cash for clunkers, which was then the big economic program being debated. Came home to Philadelphia. The following day, I was very eager to see the print treatment of the interview, because the Associated Press had been in the room for the entire exchange. The next day, here's the AP headline that ran all across the country. Oh, we don't have the right one. The headline said, "Obama mum on Book of Secrets." And if you read the story, you would think that the Philadelphia columnist and talk show host had this once-in-a-lifetime opportunity, and that's how he ended up using it. Election night 2016. I spent 9 hours on CNN's set with Anderson Cooper. 13 million people watched us that night. That's more than the white Ford Bronco chase. That's more than Michael Jackson's acquittal. That's more than Princess Diana's funeral. That's the biggest cable audience ever. I had been scheduled to be in that chair from 7 until 1, and because I had to do a radio show the following morning. And when they came for me at 1, I said, it was undecided. I said, "I can't possibly leave until this thing is known." I ended up getting out of the chair at 4 a.m. and going back to my hotel in a taxi with David Axelrod. When the campaign ended, I joked with Sean Spicer that I'd gotten him his job as press secretary. And I said that because I knew and had documented in a column the president's, the now president's, viewing habits. He would only rarely acknowledge by name that he'd been watching my show. I think because it's a CNN product, he didn't want to give that attribution. But he would say things on the campaign trail on Saturdays that came directly from discussions that had taken place on my program, something that Spicer acknowledged to me. So a year ago, at this time, on a Friday, Sean Spicer invited me to come into the White House for an off-the-record conversation, 9 a.m. meeting. And when I walked in, he made it clear that at 10 a.m., he was scheduled to meet with the President of the United States. I knew that it was time to go when Sarah Huckabee Sanders poked her head into the room at about 5 of 10. We'd had a freewheeling, off-the-record conversation, talking much more about non-political things than you might expect. I walked back to my hotel. I turned on the television just as news was breaking that Spicer had either just quit or had been fired. I was his last appointment at the White House. He had not told me that he was intending to quit or that he expected he was about to be fired, but I replayed in my mind the sum and substance of, well, what did we just discuss? And I do a great deal of public speaking across the country, often for hire, to private corporate groups. And only then did it occur to me. He was fascinated about the groups that I speak to, how much they pay me, and where I'd been recently. Perhaps Andy can bring him here next year to the Philadelphia Free Library for an event. A year ago, I conducted what was Bill Cosby's only pretrial interview. This was before trial number one. The interview generated huge attention. The biggest revelation was Cosby telling me that he would not take the stand in his own defense. But more interesting, and not revealed in my column, is this. The call for me to do the interview with Cosby had come out of the blue. I was standing in a CVS line in Doylestown to pick up a prescription for my then 87-year-old father. And when I picked up the phone, not knowing who it was, the voice at the other end of the line explained to me that it was so-and-so who was doing the PR work for Bill Cosby, and I said, I can't talk now. I'm picking up a prescription for my elderly dad. Call me later. When the phone rang later that same day, there was not one person at the other end of the line. There were now two, the PR flack and Cosby himself. And Cosby wanted to school me at the outset of the discussion about the way in which I should be medicating my dad. And I'm listening to him, considering the irony that he's about to go on trial for allegedly, I don't think I have to say allegedly now, for drugging women and sexually assaulting them, and yet Dr. Huxtable wanted to school me on what meds my dad should be taking. Couldn't make it up. By the way, might interest you to know he's an advocate of homeopathic remedies. Many celebrity moments have been column worthy, but I have most enjoyed writing about characters, many of them from Philadelphia. When I use that word, it's a term of endearment. Like my friend Steven Singer, who I do not hate. Together, we have raised more than $500,000 for 9/11 charities, and we've done it $10 at a time, selling pins that say, 9/11 never forget. That's Steven giving $25,000 last year to Ellen Saraceni. She's the widow of Victor, who was the captain of United Flight 175. My broadcast mentor, Larry Kane, shown here as a Cub reporter, 22 maybe, on the Beatles' first tour of the United States. My favorite part of the story, by the way, is that Larry had to be coaxed into going. Didn't want to join them. You know how long we've known each other? We have known each other since I was in high school and delivered chlorine to his house in Rydal. That's the day that I woke him up at 11 o'clock in the morning and claimed that he needed to sign a bill of lading before I would drop a bucket of chlorine next to his pool. I just wanted to take the picture. Another friend that I've profiled from the area, the legendary Sid Mark. Good friend. We've celebrated so many of his milestones together. I had the privilege as a lawyer of carrying the bag for James E. Beasley, the namesake of the Temple University Law School, and writing about Jim and his street smarts was another of my favorite columns. So too was my eulogy for City Councilman Thatcher Longstreth. I've been very fortunate. I said right, wrong, and fortunate at the outset. I've been so fortunate in terms of the individuals in our area who've mentored me. About a half dozen. which is why when young people want to come in and sit in my studio and watch what I'm doing, I always say yes. I also wrote about the day that I called Smokin' Joe Frazier just to tell him what he meant to me growing up. I had watched a documentary about Frazier Ali 1 on ESPN, and it gave me a sense of appreciation for Frazier that I hadn't had as an adult. And I called him at the Cloverleigh Gym at Broad and Allegheny or thereabout, and he answered the phone, and I was able to tell him how I respected him. And the gist of this column was to say, so often somebody's dying before we finally say to them, hey, you meant a great deal to me. It was a lesson I should be following more myself, but tell people you appreciate them while they're still with us. Like I said, it's often the private citizen out of the limelight that's provided my best fodder, like the Yoakum family, Frank, Claire, and their quadruplets. In a post 9/11 world, after a premature and difficult pregnancy, the Yoakum quadruplets and their parents were flying from Phoenix back to Philadelphia, and the TSA disrobed the kids and took them off their life support before letting them onto the airplane. Hence the column that I wrote, Airline Travel Screening Stupidity Times 4. Check these kids out today. Great story, right? I also wrote about a junior high school classmate who is today a Bucks County farmer and grows the best tasting tomatoes summer after summer. Fred Slack Jr. is his name. It made for a great Labor Day weekend profile. I loved when he told me that the plants have brains, and that's what he knows that the rest of us don't. Who am I to argue with him? I've enjoyed writing about those who are not household names, like Grace Snags, who worked for my wife and me for 30 years in a domestic capacity. When she was sick late in life, a year and a half or so ago, we had a role reversal. We became her caretaker. Grace was from Tobago, had a huge heart, loved to sing Red, Red Wine as she would do the laundry. I wrote this about Grace and was able to read this at her funeral. The column was published while she was still with us. When she thinks I'm too involved in affairs on the home front, which is often, she'll call me an anti-man. Only to hear her pronounce it, it's anti-mon. Grace, I wrote, also has a head full of island sayings, things like, you don't know if the roof is leaking unless you're the one living inside. I was proud to pay homage to her, and that column struck a real chord. It's interesting for me as the columnist to note, what do people most respond to? And here, I guess, is the lesson of what writing 15 years worth of columns has taught me. That often it's not the political, it's not the front page news, it's not those high profile stories that people seem to remember. When people have stopped me to engage me about something that I've written or produced on radio, it's usually to discuss the stuff about life. I'm functioning at my best when I'm delivering a Seinfeld or Larry David Curb Your Enthusiasm piece of content. Do you remember at Monk's Cafe in season 4 or 5 when Jerry and George are contemplating a TV show they want to pitch to NBC? What was the show going to be about? Nothing, right. And those columns that I have written about nothing, I've come to appreciate, are really the columns about everything. Everything meaning the fabric of our lives not separated by political divide, like family pets, or yard sales, or summer camp, or holiday decorations. My readers were struck by my assessment as to what the color of people's Christmas lights says about them. I once wrote that I grew up in a colored light household. Quote, I'm talking big, fat, colored Christmas lights. They were red, they were green, they were orange, they were blue, they were bright, they were gaudy, they were everywhere. They were beautiful and they were Christmas. But then I noted that as an adult, my house is bigger than the home in which I was raised. My car is nicer than anything my father has ever driven. My clothes are more expensive than anything he ever had on his back. And somewhere along the way, we've become white light people. White lights. Petite. Non-offensive. Uniform. The lights of power and prestige, the lights of suburban panache and urban glamour. But then I had an epiphany, an admission. I said, white lights are boring. White lights are sedate. White lights are pretentious. White lights are for fakers. White lights are un-Christmas. And so I resolved, in that column, to return my home to the home of my youth at Christmas time and become a colored light household. Now, you're applauding, but I must confess that after I wrote those words, I went home and my wife had bathed our tree in white lights. But it was a good column nonetheless, and I meant it when I said it. It drew heartfelt response, another of those subjects on which it seems everybody has an opinion, but one not based on party affiliation or ideology. Rather, something that unites us, enables us to have a laugh, even if we have a division of opinion. With today's headlines, it's easy to forget our commonalities, but they're there. And what I've found anecdotally through the response to my writing is supported in political science. The typical Republican and Democratic voter have not adopted more extreme ideological views in the last 30 years. Sadly, what many have done is to think worse of the other side. It has become personal, but not driven by issue division. We still have our political disagreements. Don't misunderstand what I'm saying, but what I believe is that at our core, we're interested in and striving for the same things for ourselves and for our families. We want good health. We want long lives. We want the ability to prosper. We want success for our kids. We want to have fun. We want to be left alone to worship or not. And we want good things for our country. And when I say we, I'm referring to those of us who are Republican, who are Democratic, who are independent, who are conservatives, who are liberals, regardless of whether we live in red or blue states. And that, ladies and gentlemen, is a lesson that I hope you will take from the book should you read it. So thank you very much. Okay, how do we do this? You're looking for me for direction? How about the woman in red?
Michael, I've loved you before people even knew who you were. You had an interview with Jake Tapper recently. You made a comment that was pretty startling to me.
Uh-oh, I'm nervous. What did I say?
You said that you don't think the current resident in the White House is going to make a run for a second term.
Well, okay, so bet against anything I say relative to Trump, because I was wrong about everything. And, you know, it was 3 years ago Saturday that he descended the escalator and announced that he was running. And over the weekend, there was a meme that was published online with a number of media personalities who were laughing at the prospect of him running, much less being elected president. I wasn't included. But I felt that in an effort to be honest with my audience, I needed to remind them. I did this on radio Monday, I guess. And I played some tape of myself having fun at his expense with that idea. Because he had, for 24 years, he had said he was thinking of running for, you know the old line, people are asking me to do it. So this go-round, what I said to Jake, I think, is I'm not convinced he's running. Despite that which he says, nothing would surprise me, including that he would determine at some point in the next year that he has made America great again, that the economy is on fire, that he's deserving of the Nobel Peace Prize because of the meeting with Kim, et cetera, and he's going to go to Mar-a-Lago. Nothing would surprise me. I'm just not convinced that he loves the job. But again, Do not wager anything on what you hear from me when it comes to him. Yes, sir, the gentleman on the aisle.
Thank you very much for your remarks and the entertainment. You were a supporter of Obama during his two terms, I believe. How did he disappoint you when you look back on his two terms?
Not much. I have zero regrets over the ballot that I cast in 2008 or in 2012. I had been a very active Republican from 1980 when I registered, grew up in a Republican household. There was really not a question as to in which party will I register. I followed the lead of my parents. And I was very happy in the GOP throughout the course of the 80s and served in Papa Bush's administration that was in the early 90s. But along the way, there's no doubt, if you read this book, you'll see changes in my opinions on a variety of issues. I acknowledge that. I wear that proudly, as a matter of fact. I think we all change in our opinions. What separates me from the rest of you is that mine are in granite. You know where I was because it was in print. And your position on an issue at any particular time is only as strong as people's memory who are around you. So I changed, no doubt. But the party changed. There's no way that George Herbert Walker Bush, Papa Bush, the epitome of a good Republican in my mind, could win a nomination in this incarnation of the GOP. So the party was shifting, I think, in a more extreme direction as we were sort of passing in the night. And so in 2008, after a great deal of thought, I cast my first ever ballot for a Democrat running for president. I'd voted for many Democrats. But this was a big moment for me. And it was very much to my professional detriment. Because to succeed in my business, you surely don't vote for a Democratic candidate for president, much less acknowledge it on the air. But I had very strong feelings, driven in large part by the way in which I thought the Bush administration had taken its eye off the ball in the war on terror and the hunt for bin Laden. So I cast that ballot in good conscience, told my audience what I was doing. Many of them have never, will never forgive me for what they regarded as some kind of an act of heresy. But I could go through things like drawing a red line in Syria. I don't have an objection to Obama not delivering on the red line. I think he was mistaken to ever draw the red line. Candidly, I've got boys who are teenagers. I don't want them fighting in Syria. That's a change of perspective in my view. Before I had kids, I probably would have been thumping my chest like you hear on one of the cable outlets. So there are definitely a number of issues I could identify for you where I wish he hadn't done this. I wish he had done something differently. But by and large, proud of the two votes that I cast for him. Never disgraced the office. Solid citizen, ethically sound, good father, good husband. And by the way, I don't mean to answer. Pardon me for getting along with it. I didn't mean to answer that like, you know, why are you asking? Let me. No, you didn't ask it with you just asked it as a point of curiosity, and I didn't mean to say it in a negative way. Let me go to this side over here because there's a gentleman with a goatee right there. Yeah, that's you. A beard. There you go.
Can you say why you're putting the effort in to write these books, not just this one, write the books, and not take the profits? What are some of the positives that you get out of this in your busy schedule?
I've written 7 books, and 4 of them I've donated the profits to charity. The first book that I wrote was called Flying Blind, and the money went to the Garden of Reflection in Bucks County, which is the official Pennsylvania tribute to those that we lost on September 11. It's one turn off of I-95, and it's really a special place. I thought it would have been unseemly. I didn't set out to write that book. And it just sort of organic grew, and I thought it would have been unseemly to profit from writing a book about my prescription for airline security post-September 11. I told Maureen Faulkner's story. I wrote her memoir for her and had similar feelings. Given the subject matter, didn't feel right. I was paid $200,000 to write that book. We created a 501c3, and that money went for the education of kids whose parents are the victims of murder. The Flight 93 memorial became a subject at which, about which I was passionate, and there's a story of an INS agent named Jose Melendez Perez that I wanted to tell because I didn't think he'd gotten his just due for keeping the 20th hijacker, Muhammad al-Qahtani, out of the country. Same thing, gave the money to the Flight 93 memorial. And in this instance, my wife works awfully hard, obviously without compensation, for the most worthy of charities in our community that I'd never heard of until she started bringing home the stories of what CCTC did. And it just felt right. I mean, I wanted to publish this book because I wanted to have record of how I looked at the world in that post-9/11 era, and I wanted to revisit the subjects. I wanted to correct the record, or I wanted to thump my chest and say I was right about that. So it just felt right. And I have to tell you a quick story. Hey, Andy, how am I doing? Because you know I can talk all night. Okay, 15 more? Okay, so can I use that microphone, sir? Can I use yours? I don't want to stand behind that lectern the whole time. So I had this idea. The idea was there's a website, and it's called Charity Buzz. And Charity Buzz takes celebrities. I don't regard myself as I'm a C or D lister, but I mean like real celebrities who are willing to donate experiences. And Charity Buzz auctions off experiences, and whoever is the high bidder, they write a check to the charity of the choice of that celebrity. And I, from time to time, I look at some of the offerings that are on this website. Like you can go meet Trevor Noah and watch his show, or Stephen Colbert, or get a Van Halen guitar or something like that. So I had this idea, and the idea was that I would auction off me coming to someone's book club anywhere in the country to talk about my new book. And when I pitched it to Charity Buzz, they initially wouldn't do it. They said, why don't you just have a studio tour? And I said, because I do studio tours all the time for charities in Philadelphia, and they go for about $500, and I'd like to do better. So finally, I was able to convince them to do this. So for 2 weeks, we had an auction, and I promoted it heavily on radio. It was great radio fodder. And I said to my producer, I have this tremendous producer, TC, who very hardworking. She deserves it. And I said, I just don't want to be embarrassed. And she said to me, well, what's the number? And I said, well, we need $1,000. Somebody's got to bid $1,000, but the number's $5,000. I mean, after all, I'm coming to somebody's house. I hope they're going to write a big check. I mixed up continental United States. I thought continental United States was everything but Hawaii and Alaska. Apparently, I'm referring to the contiguous United States. So I went on air the first day I launched this. Hey, go bid. I'll come to your house for your book club anywhere in the continental United States. A caller called in and said, you're now on the hook for the whole country. Okay. The first day, the bidding was tremendous. $1,000, $2,000, $3,000, $5,000, $10,000. And that's where it ended. And then there was silence for the next 10 days. And on the final day of the auction, I thought, and 10 grand is great. I thought maybe we're done at 10. And then the bidding commenced again. They had to extend it 3 times. Long story short, Lydia in Dallas paid $25,000 to CCTC, and I'm going to her house in October. The runner-up was a guy named Charlie from Long Island. He was at 24-5. Lydia said, I'm not offended if Charlie wants you to go to his house too. I called Charlie off air. He said, I don't have a book club and I don't want you to come to my house, but I'll write a check for 25 grand. So $50,000 out of the box for the charity. Yeah, isn't that great? Really great. So, okay. This gentleman right here. Is that you, Denny? Hey, how are you?
What's the next book?
I'm not going to write another book. I told Andy at the outset tonight, I have a... So the last book was a novel, Talk. I wanted to comment on how I think mostly men with microphones have driven this country into a ditch by taking control of our political debate. And I wanted to say something about that. It would have been easy for me to write that book nonfiction, but I thought I'd like to take some liberties and have some fun. Frankly, I want to use foul language and I want to write about sex. So I thought it would be easier than it was, but I got it done, and the book is called Talk, and I'm very proud of Talk. Warner Brothers came along, and they acquired the television rights. And for a while, I really thought this was going to happen, but people in Hollywood are so full of it, you can't imagine. That project is still out there somewhere. I like to joke, Denny, that it's in that warehouse at the end of Raiders of the Lost Ark where they take the Ark of the Covenant. Like, somewhere in there is my book. But I enjoyed the experience. I enjoyed the experience of being out there and trying to get a show on the air. I'm going back tomorrow because I'm on Bill Maher Friday night. And you cheer, but you may or may not remember. We didn't have such a good visit the first time I was on that show. But I have a screenplay in my head. There's something I'm really eager to write. And if I could only find the time, I want to express myself and write a story. It's a fiction story for television. So that's what I'd like to do next if I have the opportunity. There was somebody right back here who had a question as well. Maybe not. Okay, yes, the woman on the aisle. How's that? I hate to be the bad guy of deciding who goes. Go ahead.
Hi, Micah, long-time fan.
Thank you.
And I know you've been asked or you've discussed this a little bit over the years, but I know your long-term goals, I want to hear a little bit more about that. I know you want to make an impact. Do you think you can make more of an impact, TV, radio, columnist, or is politics something you've been talking
about? So thank you for even broaching that subject. When I was in law school, a state legislative seat in Central Bucks came open. My father had run for this seat in 1980. My father worked as a guidance counselor for all of his adult life, was interested in politics but never active in politics, ran and lost in an open seat in 1980. 1986, I'm in my second year of law school at Penn, the seat opens, and I was all full of something and vinegar for politics at the time, and I ran for that seat. I ran for that seat in my second year of law school. I lost in a Republican primary by 419 votes. I have since located 236 of those people. You know that joke does not make sense. If you think about it logically, it doesn't make sense. It was a wonderful experience, no regrets. If you said to me, you can rewrite that chapter of your life tomorrow, you're going to lose, so we can erase it. Go knock on 5,000 doors. You'll learn more about your neighbors and your community and what goes on in the world than any classroom setting available. So I loved the experience. We have four kids. We've got a lot of tuition that we're paying. But I do not rule that out because I mean everything that I say, and I want somebody to test the model. See, our debate has been hijacked by the fringes. And these fringe folks among us are able to control the nomination process because of closed primaries in a state like Pennsylvania. And I believe that we are being led by people who are unrepresentative of the majority view. But here's what they have that we don't, to the extent we might be looking at this issue in similar fashion. They have passion. I have passion. The one thing that you could say that would get under my skin is to say, well, you're a centrist or an independent and you're lacking in conviction. Oh, no. I have plenty of conviction. My conviction just doesn't line up neatly in those faux ideological boxes. I mean, I live a very normal existence in the suburbs of Philadelphia. And when I am pumping gas or at a back-to-school night, or sharing the grocery responsibility with my wife, people stop and engage me in conversation. And when I travel, because the television role has given me an added level of visibility, so people are constantly engaging me in dialogue. I don't meet people who see the world entirely through progressive or conservative lenses. I just don't. The people that I speak to see the issues as a mixed bag. They're liberal on some things, usually the social issues. and conservative on other things, usually the economic issues. And there's a hell of a lot they just don't have figured out, and neither do I. But where is the representation for us who view the world that way and are not afraid to say, I just don't know. I haven't figured it out. I haven't thought deeply enough about it. So I'm waiting for somebody. I'd love to you know, latch on to somebody who's going to take that kind of a shot and say, enough already with extremism. How about some critical thinking that's center-based? And if nobody does it, and if the kids are all educated, then yes, I'll do it. Okay? Yes, go ahead. I took your microphone.
Hi, Michael. I have an observation and a question. The observation is you forgot to mention about Barack Obama that he has a vocabulary that's larger than 10 words. And also, I want to know how I can meet your producer, TC, because I love her interaction with you. She does not let you get away with her. She's your work wife.
So my producer was a Montessori school teacher for three of our four kids. And somewhere along the way, she was invited to sell candles for QVC, flameless candles. And she got a little taste of the media. And my wife and I surmised she was probably not long for the teaching world. And I'll never forget when I wanted to hire her, CBS moved me to mornings. They fired Don Imus, and they moved me to mornings, and I needed a producer. And there was a guy on paper who was seemingly perfectly qualified, but we didn't click. And I knew TC as the teacher of our kids, and I thought she'd be great because she's bright, and she's engaging and hardworking. And I remember CBS saying, you must be joking. We're now paying you this amount of money to do a morning show. This is big time. And you want to hire the school teacher? And I said, I do. And I don't know how long we've worked together, but it has to be, you know, I'd be embarrassed if she were here. But it has to be like 13 or 14 years. And it works. And she's got a great temperament for me and balance. And I thank you for saying that on her behalf. One more. Okay, Andy, don't make me decide who it is, okay? Okay, there we go.
A lot of columns and a lot of broadcasting. If you had to give up one or the other, which would it be?
So I'm spread a bit too thin right now. I don't know for how much longer I will be able to sustain writing the column. I know when you read it, you have no idea the amount of time that goes into it. But they really take a tremendous amount of time. So I don't know for how much longer I'll be able to do that, which is candidly another reason why I wanted the book to be there. I expect that I'll continue to be on radio and television through 2020. I got to see how this ends. I got to see how this ends. Thank you all very much. I appreciate it.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.